Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started. I've got lots and lots of content, almost two talks worth, so I'm going to go really fast, but hopefully all good content and stuff you can take advantage of. How many people here are using ASP.NET MVC today? Great. Hopefully you'll want to use it even more after the talk's over. I'm going to have an unplug session right after this talk, so if I don't get a chance to answer your question at the end or we run out of time to do questions at the end, know that there's a whole other full hour of me that you can ask any ASP.NET MVC, any Azure, or any other related question you want, and be happy to answer more questions there. One thing I should mention up front, a lot of people have asked me, like, oh, we're so sorry you've left ASP.NET and you're now working on Azure. I should actually be clear, I still own ASP.NET, I still work on ASP.NET, this team still works for me. And so I actually haven't left ASP.NET. In fact, pretty much all the .NET server pieces actually work for me. And so I am focusing a lot on Azure the last couple of months, but rest assured, my heart still belongs to ASP.NET and the .NET pieces. So working on those as well. But for this session, I'm specifically going to be talking about ASP.NET MVC, and specifically V4, which we just shipped the beta of this morning. And so all the demos I'm going to show here today, you can do as well. And hopefully, if I get a free hour tomorrow, I'm going to write a blog post about them that you can actually download and try them out on your own local machine. So the MVC 4 release has lots of new features, and I'm only going to get a chance to touch on a couple of them here this today, but hopefully a couple pretty exciting ones that you'll like. We've got great productivity features like bundling and minification, database migrations that make your life as developers a lot easier. We also have some really cool new APIs and capabilities, things like web APIs, mobile web, real-time communication, and async that go beyond just productivity, but also really enable new scenarios. And we think are going to let you build even better and more modern web apps than ever before. And the cool thing is, all these features I'm going to show today work with VS 2010 and .NET 4, so you don't need a new version of VS. You don't have to install anything on a server in order to run MVC 4. You just actually deploy your application, and it's been deployable, the actual framework assemblies, and so it'll just work in any hosting environment, whether it's Azure or whether it's your own local hosting solution. So it's really easy to take advantage of, and the MVC4 beta does have a go-live license, so if you want to start using some of these features, you can start doing it immediately. So with that, let's actually go into Visual Studio. We're going to do lots of demos here today. I'm going to start off by doing one here. And just do file new project. And so MVC 4 installs side by side with MVC 2, 3, and other releases. And so if I want to, I can just say new, what do you want to name the project? Redshirt 3. Redshirt 3, okay. I think the last one was Redshirt 2, the last session. So we're going to name it's Redshirt 3, and we're going to use MVC 4. Why don't we call it Redshirt 4, just so we don't get all confused, especially me. It will match the version number there. When you click that, you'll notice we get a new project template dialog that has a few more options than we've had in previous releases. In particular, we have a new mobile application template, which I talked a little bit about in the keynote this morning. We'll talk a little bit more later on in this talk. We also have a new web API template. That provides kind of a template if you just want to build a pure web API solution, although you can also add mobile and web API to standard internet project templates as well. And we also have a single page app template if you want to build a rich Ajax experience that is doing most of the client binding on the client side and then calling to things like web API on the server side. So for this app, I'm just going to use the internet template and hit OK. And this is basically scaffold out for me a site that has a bunch of features in it. We're going to be coming back to this site repeatedly over the next couple sections, and we're going to add a whole bunch of features to it. I'm just going to run it now, though, so you can get a sense of what it looks like. It's a little bit prettier than our old version of our site that we've shipped in previous MVC releases, and so we've spent a little bit more time on styling, but we've also, more importantly, updated it to kind of include new best practices. So it uses Modernizer, it uses semantic HTML markup, it uses bundling by default, so that the JavaScript as well as the CSS is really tight and small, and if you basically drill into it, it's also easy to customize. You can see here we're using sections, which is sort of a semantic HTML5 tag. We also, for login and registration, now support Ajax-based login and registration, but we fall back if you don't have JavaScript. So it's kind of a nice, modern, clean look and feel. We're also looking probably for the final release to integrate OAuth support, OAuth support for login as well. So in addition to using FormsAuth, you could also use Facebook, Google+, LiveID, or any other OAuth-based solution to log in as well. So nice, modern app, makes it easy to get started, and we're going to come back to this a few more times throughout the talk. Let's talk about a couple features then. First one I'm talking about is two features that are often used together, one called bundling and one called minification. How many people here do bundling or minification? That sounds very personal. But we have this built in, and so you can now take advantage of it within your applications. And for people that are wondering, I have no idea what this means, why I would care about this. Basically, it makes your sites faster, and it makes your app experience better for your users. So it's a good feature. It's one you want to take advantage of, and it's really easy to do now with a new MVC 4 release. And basically, the way it does this is by reducing the number and size of HTTP requests that you make within your application. And by reducing the number of individual calls and by reducing the payload of each call, the page loads faster for the user, feels faster, and they're happier. And it works by convention, so there's no configuration required in order to enable it. You don't need to run a post-build step, which is what a lot of people do today. Instead, you can just drop files in a directory, and it just works. At the same time, though, it's fully customizable and extensible, so that if you want to plug in your own custom pipeline or you want to do custom post-processing or you want to use CoffeeScript or Less or SAS or other languages that transform into JavaScript or CSS, you can do that as well, and it works great. So how does this work? So conceptually, the way to think about bundling and minification, imagine you have a project that has a bunch of scripts and a bunch of style sheets, and you split them out into separate files. The way you'd reference them today from a page would be just sort of standard link references, and then you do, in this case here, six separate HTTP calls to six separate style sheets. What you can do with bundling and minification is basically shrink that down into one link reference that instead of pointing at individual files, you just point to the directory name and you say slash CSS. And on the server side now, ASP.NET, when you send a request like that, will look in that directory, find all the CSS style sheets, merge them together, strip out white space, strip out comments, and send down a single HTTP payload to the browser. Everything renders the same way, but now it renders much faster because I'm doing it as a single HTTP request. Likewise, with JavaScript, I can now just send, instead of lots of separate JavaScript files, I can just say scripts slash JS, because scripts is the folder. Slash JS just indicates the content type I want to pull from the folder. And ASP.NET will, again, take all the JavaScript files, merge them together, strip out the white space in CSS, and send it down. So let's see that in action. So a simple app here I'm going to run. It's called the Bundling and Minification app. And if you look at the HTML here, I have a layout file. Looks like this. And so you can see here I have two CSS references. I've got five JavaScript references. Some of these references are for framework libraries, like jQuery and Knockout. And some of these are kind of custom scripts that are app-specific. And right now, if we run this page, and let's use F12 to look at the browser tools, hit Start Capture, you'll see that this page is doing a bunch of separate independent HTTP requests. Notice that some of them take different amounts of time. If I have lots of files, they'll actually sometimes be staggered because the browser will only do a certain number of requests at the same time. And it's going to, you know, each one of these, in some cases, is a pretty hefty file in terms of size. So what I can do to make this site load a little faster is basically just comment these things out. And instead, I'm going to use an approach like this. So I can still use just static HTML files. Static HTML, there's no server-side handlers at all, no custom methods I need to call. Instead, I just say slash content slash CSS slash script slash JS slash script slash custom slash JS. And I'm going to create automatically three separate bundles, so three HTTP payloads that merge all those files together and pull them into my page. And so now when I rerun this app, everything works exactly the same. I don't need to change any of my markup. If I go view source now, I just have three references. And if I look at the F12 tools, you'll see I have fewer HTTP requests coming down. And one thing you might notice is that the payload is actually a lot smaller. So for example, my JavaScript payload is actually smaller because if I double click on it and look at the response, we've pulled out all the white space, we've merged it down and minified it. We even kind of compressed some of the variables so that it is really lightweight and easy. If I go to the content of the CSS, notice we've merged all the CSS together. And so the original files look like so, where I have a reset file and a site CSS file. Now, when I send them down using the tools, if I zoom in here, you can see we've compressed it all, we've merged it all, it's fast, it's minified, your users will be happier. The nice thing about this is you can still, as a developer, have separate files. So a lot of people use a reset approach to kind of clear out styles across different browsers. I can separate that file out because it's kind of a standard boilerplate file, and then I can have, if I want to, multiple CSS files to logically define the styles for my site. Likewise, for my custom scripts, I could have a framework folder as well as a custom folder or whatever I want to call it. And again, it's just sort of by convention, just create the right structure you want, reference the folder, and away you go. In addition to being able to just reference things directly as standard HTML elements, we also have built in a couple of helpers. In the beta, they're a tiny bit verbose in that they're called system.web.optimization.bundletables.bundle.resolve.bundle.url. And one bit of feedback I gave the team was like, maybe we could make that a little smaller. And so it's probably going to be called html.bundle as a helper in the final release. You might ask, well, why would I do that instead of this? Well, this feature, this helper actually does one extra thing, which is kind of nice, is if you actually look at the HTML, and we'll zoom it in so you can see it. Unlike the static ones that I had earlier, you'll notice that this references the same folder structure, but then it adds onto it kind of a magic string. And basically, this magic string is looking at the contents of your directory on the server, and it's basically creating a unique hash that represents the contents. And then what ASP.NET will do is say, cache this file for a year. And so that file, if the user closes their browser and comes back, within the next year, they're never going to even request that same file. The browser will just serve it directly out of its local cache. The beauty is, if you ever make a change to the JavaScript or change to the CSS, we'll automatically send down a new magic string, which means the browser will automatically request the new version of the file. And so that gives you a way that you can actually edge cache things in the browser or on intermediate proxy caches, but the string gives you a cache-busting token so that if the file ever does change or any of your scripts ever change, your users always pick up the new version. And the beauty is, it's all built in. All you need to do is just create a directory structure, stick standard CSS and JavaScript on the system, and you get it for free. So a really easy way to take advantage of it. Hopefully a lot of benefits you can get from it. This works not only with standard JavaScript and CSS and with this kind of convention directory-based approach. You can also, if you go into your global.sax file, register explicit routes or explicit bundles that you want to use. So this just sort of enables the default convention-based approach where we have directories. If I wanted to have a named style or a named bundle like my custom bundle where I have explicit files in certain orders, I can also do that. I can also, if I wanted to, register my own custom rules and custom bundlers. And so this is an example of registering a CoffeeScript or a less bundler in the system. And what I can do here is I'm just going to say treat everything inside a folder that has a .coffee extension as a coffee bundle. And so now I could just say within my site, I could drop in. How many people here are using CoffeeScript? How many people here have heard of CoffeeScript? How many people here drink coffee? Okay, well, it actually is unrelated, but it's interesting. This is an example of CoffeeScript. It's kind of a meta language or higher level language that compiles down into JavaScript. So it's a little bit more functional. People either typically love it or hate it. The cool thing here is I just dropped two coffee files in my folder here called scripts, and I just basically have a coffee folder. And what I can do is just within my browser now is I'm just linking to that bundle by just saying /script/coffee/coffee. And when I do that and click it, ASP.NET will automatically take those multiple files, merge them, minify them, run the CoffeeScript post-processor on them and send down standard JavaScript to execute inside the browser. Likewise, if you want to use LESS, which is a CSS higher level language. So for example, with the nice thing about LESS is instead of having to hard code strings, values all over the place, you can define variables like brand color and then reuse them in multiple style sheet rules. Again, I can just register a custom post-processor for LESS and then just link to the LESS script. And this is what it looks like after it's been expanded by LESS into separate rules, merged and minified by ASP.NET and sent down to the browser. So a really easy way, improve your performance of your site. You can more easily integrate things like LESS, CoffeeScript, SAS, and other things into your system, get better perf, and have a really nice developer workflow. And the nice thing is it's just built in and you can take advantage of it. So that's a little bit of bundling minification. It works not only for MVC, it'll actually work for web forms as well. So you can take advantage of any type of ASP.NET app, hopefully provide some nice developer productivity, and it's pretty easy to use and get big wins from it. How many people here use Razor today? Okay, a lot of people do. It's a new templating language we introduced with MVC 3, it's really great. Makes it allow you to write really concise, terse code, it's a lot of fun to use. A couple of things that we've done with this new MVC release is actually updated Razor to have a few more features. And we've looked really hard at what are the types of patterns that people do over and over with Razor. And anytime we see something where it's a little verbose, we try to make it simpler and a little bit more elegant. One thing we noticed a lot is that people often have hard-coded URLs or have to do, actually not hard-coded URLs, but they want to basically have relative URLs that they fully qualify within their code. An example is using URL.content to reference a site.js relative to the root of the project. And so anyone here ever used URL.content or server.matpath or things like that? Yeah. What you can do now inside Razor is you no longer have to call any function in order to do it. You can just use the tilde syntax within any HTML element, and Razor will automatically expand that at runtime to be the fully right qualified URL for you automatically. So again, just makes it a little bit simpler, a little bit easier to work with URLs and take advantage of within your app. How many people here ever write code like this in Razor, which is kind of nasty code, which is basically where I want to conditionally show an attribute on an HTML element and assign a value to it? And Razor for today allows you to do really elegantly, just you put an if-else block inside your HTML, and it's smart enough about parsing where the HTML starts and ends and makes it really elegant. Where it's not so elegant today is if you do that inside an HTML attribute that you want to conditionally show or not. So in other words, if this class isn't set, I want to hide the actual class HTML element so that there's nothing on the element. And this is kind of how you do it today, which is not very intuitive and not very clean. What you can do now with the new Razor is you just say class equals at my class, and the Razor parser is smart enough, so if it's an HTML element and the value is null, it won't actually output the class either. And so this would actually just be div content if no CSS is actually present. And if you want to be really clever, you can even say my class space my other class, and if you want to use with CSS multiple class names, which is a feature that CSS supports, Razor is also smart enough to support that as well. Again, just saves you some typing, makes it a little bit cleaner, allows you to write really elegant, clean code, just built in with the next version of Razor that comes with MVC. How many people here use a database? What are the people that don't raise their hand? What do you do, actually? A couple of you will do, that's great, and we want to make that better. So one of the other features that's new in MVC 4 is support for what we call database migrations. And so one of the things we did in MVC 3 is we shipped EF Code First by default with the tooling update that we did last spring. EF Code First is a really kind of nice iteration of the Entity Framework ORM. It supports a kind of convention or configuration-based object relational mapper. Allows you to kind of, with code, cleanly define your models using kind of what we call plain old CLR objects or POCO objects. And with MVC 3, we had a bunch of tooling support that allowed you to easily kind of scaffold controllers and views based on it. Gives you a lot of nice dev productivity, lets you write some really clean code. One thing, though, that you know, you still have to today manually handle yourself is what happens when you're doing development and you want to evolve the database schema. So in other words, You want to add a property. You want to rename a property. You want to change something from non-nullable to nullable or vice versa. Today, you're going to have to manually handle that. And writing the SQL change script by hand that preserves all the data inside the database is kind of a pain. And there's lots of tools out there that help with it. But what we tried to do with this release is bake in support automatically to make it a lot easier, make it code-focused, make it dev-friendly, but at the same time also allow it so that after you as a developer have changed your app schema, you can also still automatically generate a standard.sql file that you can give to a DBA who can look at it and make sure you didn't do anything stupid, or that you can import into a SQL Management Studio and actually run against your production database to actually migrate your data and migrate your schema without losing anything. And we call, this is just sort of built in, and you can take advantage of it. So I'm going to show this off using MVC4. One tip, the beta that's available today has a version of the Entity Framework that's a couple weeks old. The Entity Framework just actually shipped the final release of 4.3 a couple days ago, and it actually has migrations built in. So this is actually a shipping released feature that you can use, not just inside MVC4, but you can use it in MVC3 now, as well as within web forms or any other project type. The one tip is just make sure you do an update package entity framework when you load your project to make sure you pick up the new version that has this new feature. So, let's not show that. Let's go back to our Redshirt app. Let me close that. So, we're back in our Redshirt app, let's do some data. What type of database do you want to build? What data do we want to store in our Redshirt project? T-shirts. How do we call them products? And we'll have different types of shirt products that we can do. So we'll create a product.cs class, and I'm going to add it in my, I added it in the wrong place. I'm going to add it in my models folder. And we'll create a database around it. So I got a product class. It's in my models folder. Let's just start off, and we'll add a few properties. We'll have an ID property. We'll do a name property. That's enough to start off with. So we got two properties. And what I want to do here is I want to build a site and a database around my products. And so with MVC3, we added support so you can scaffold controllers automatically. So I just right-click, say new products controller. I'm going to say scaffold it based on the product class, and I want to create a store DB context, and I'm going to hit add. So this is actually all shipping and built into MVC3, and what this is doing now is creating for me a entity framework class as well as a set of files in order to do it. And remember how I said don't forget to update your entity framework? I did forget to update it. So I'm going to do one other thing before we run it, which is type update package entity framework. So I'm just going to use the NuGet command line to make sure I have the latest version of the entity framework when I run this. And you can see here it just updated it. But because I've already opened the old version, I do need to actually reopen the project in order to pick up the new version. And then we'll actually go ahead and run this and see it in action. So Redshirt 4, there we go. So we got controller scaffolding, we got view scaffolded. Again, this is what the code looks like. This is just standard MVC3. And when I go ahead and run this app now and hit the slash products controller, you can see here, this is the page that we scaffolded. I can just say create new, and we'll say Redshirt. And because there's actually multiple types of red shirts, we have red polo shirts. And orange shirt, given that where we're at. And away we go. So we had a couple rows of data inside our database. One of the beauties about EF Code First is you can start with your code. And you might be wondering, how did this get stored? Well, it actually, if you go to our database open up a .sql express, and I basically search for it here. You can see here we have Redshirt 4.models.database, And if I open this up, I got a products table that has two columns in it, and it's storing those three shirts. So that's all works in the existing version of Entity Framework. That's great. But what I want to do now is I want to evolve this database schema because my store actually needs to have prices as well. And that's where today it's not as elegant. And with the new database migration feature that's built into MVC4, it gets a lot cleaner. So how do we do this? Well, what I want to do is add another property to my POCO model here. But I want to keep the data. I want to evolve the database without having to regenerate. I want to keep all those three red shirts that I upload, or the two red shirts and one orange shirt, in my database as I do so. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to type a command called enable migrations inside the command console. And what this is going to do is, if I go back to my Solution Explorer now, is it added a couple of files into my project. It created a migrations folder right here. And as a configuration file, it just has a couple of properties that you can change. And it has a class that it automatically generated here, which is called my initial create class. There's a little weird number before it. That's a timestamp. And so you can see what order the migrations run in. And basically inside this method here, it has what's called an up and a down method. The up method basically contains the code necessary to create the database in the current state of both my POCO class as well as my current database. And so you can see here we created a table called products that has two properties, two columns, and a primary key. The down actually just drops the table. And so basically you can run the up to create it. You can go down to reset it to an empty state. What I can then do, and let's close a bunch of these other ones so we don't get confused, is add my property to my class here. And so we're going to say decimal, call it price maybe. And so I basically have just added a price property to this. Now, if I were to run this right now, I'd have a conflict because I have a non-nullable column or non-nullable property, and I don't have a corresponding column in the database. So what I can do to enable this now, though, is I can just say add migration, and I can say add product price or any other friendly name I want as part of this. When I do this, this will automatically create for me a new file in my migrations folder that has another timestamp, so it's in order, and then it has another up and down method. And basically this up method just says, hey, you're going to add a column called price, and you're defining it to be nullable. And if I now say update database, this will actually apply all the migrations. And if I hit refresh over here in the Server Explorer, my database now has the database schema. And more importantly, if I actually open my data, or not, my data will still be there. Just to prove that, let's go back to our HTML view. I could rescaffold the view, or in this case here, just so you know exactly what I'm doing. Oh, interesting. My keyboard no longer deletes keys. I'm not sure what just happened there. Something in Windows is going weird. Let us hope. Yeah, can I please fix the bug? It's annoying. I agree, it's annoying. I will give that feedback to the appropriate person when I get home. But I'm going to go ahead here and copy and paste. Oh, there we go. Now it works. That's very odd. I'm not sure that's a VS bug or that's a Windows bug, but it's exciting that we had that in front of thousands of people. So I'm just going to go ahead and add the price here into the index so that now when we run this, we should see listed here the price. And if I go into the create one now and copy and paste this, Again, I could rescaffold the view, but I just want to kind of show the changes happening in real time so you know what's going on. I can now say blue shirt. And away you go. So basically, we've evolved our schema, we've added a new column, and the beauty is we didn't lose any data. If I want to change things more, let's say, for example, let's make the name property here. Right now, if you look at it in the Server Explorer, you can see that the name property is nullable, which is the default in BS, you can say, or in SQL, so it says nullable equals true. Let's make it non-nullable. So one way to do that in code first is I can actually just add what's called a required attribute, like so. I could then go to the package manager console, and I'm just going to say add migration again. And we're going to name this change product name required. Again, this will look at my schema. It'll look at the database, see what the difference is, and say, oh, we're going to alter the column to make it nullable or non-nullable. And I can then go ahead and say update database. This will apply the migration. And now if I hit refresh and click on the name, you can see nullable is false. So pretty easy way. You can make rapid changes to your schema and your objects and keep your database in sync. The beauty about this is, so I'm naming each of these migrations. And so you can see here I have different timestamps for each of them. If I ever want to roll back to a previous state, I can also do that. I can say update database, target migration, and I could say add product price. Like so. And this will actually roll back my schema to the previous state, again, preserving my data. And so now I no longer have it be nullable. If I went and looked at this again, what I should find is it's rolled back to be nullable, and then if I want to roll it forward, I can do that again and roll forward either to the latest state if I don't specify any migration, or I can name any migration I want in order to go forward. And the reason for that is because there's both an up and a down method, and so I know how to walk back and walk forward with the changes and preserve the data. People often ask questions, can I rename columns? Yep, there's a helper method there called rename column that you can do. You can execute arbitrary SQL if you want. So if you want to do things like change a price from a decimal to a different format, that it would be a destructive change if you just change the data type. You can actually write inline SQL as part of your up-down statement to put it in a temp variable and convert it yourself as part of the migration. You can do lots of power. It also has a provider model so that you can use it against Oracle, you can use it against MySQL, or other types of databases as well. And what's nice is when you're actually all in, set and done, and you're ready to actually deploy this app that has the changes, you can also go ahead and just bump the font up here. Ooh, that's very big. Let's make it. Is you can also go ahead and just say update database script, and you can say source migration. So in other words, where are we starting from? And we're just going to say initial database. And then you can say target migration. Where do you want to actually generate the migrate script to? And so I could either pick the most recent version, or just say sort of say change product name required. Change product name required. Hopefully I spelled that right. And when I run that, instead of actually applying it to the database, it's instead going to change create the .sql file automatically for you. So you can pass this off to a DBA. Or a question that came up in the Azure discussion earlier, how do I change my SQL Azure database? Cool thing is you can just save this to Dix or copy-paste it into the SQL admin tool, execute it against your SQL Azure database, and you've just migrated your schema. And then, so this gives you a way to easily deploy your initial app, and then every time you do a code update that changes the database, this provides an easy way for you to do an incremental change of your schema on your production box. But anyone that still wants to know exactly what's going on under the covers, the good news is you can just look at the .sql file. You can hand tweak it before you deploy it if you want to, and you're still in full control as part of the system. Other nice thing about this is it integrates well with source control. And so because these migrations can be checked in and because there's a timestamp, if you have multiple devs working at the same time on a project, they can each check in separate migration scripts, and then you can actually resolve them together at source control time. And everything can be automated from the command line. So in addition to doing it from the PowerShell window that's built into NuGet, you can also do it from a build server or a continuous integration system, and you can also just run it from a vanilla command line within Windows. So pretty easy way to take advantage of it. Again, you can use it in any type of .NET project. It's not tied to ASP.NET MVC 4, and the beauty is it's actually now shipping in released form. And so if you go to NuGet and just say update package entity framework, you get the latest version, and you can do all these things yourself. So hopefully it makes it a lot easier. You'll see even more support coming out this spring so that when you actually use, for example, right-click and hit publish inside Visual Studio to do a web deploy, we'll actually integrate with this as well so that we can now do automatic database diffs as well as part of publishing and kind of streamline that process end-to-end. So it's a feature a lot of people have asked for. Other frameworks, I should mention, do have this. Rails popularized this. Other frameworks have migration scripts as well. We try to take some of the best ideas. And then I think some of the entity framework integration, which allows you to kind of integrate with the strongly typed model of your POCO classes, helps streamline it hopefully even more, gives you a lot of power, a lot of productivity, and hopefully makes your lives as developers even easier. So that's migrations. Moving along, other new features, web APIs. How many people here are exposing web APIs inside their apps? Cool. How many people here have heard of web APIs? Cool. How many people here drink coffee? No, same number, fewer people than last time. But one of the things we're investing in pretty heavily with this release is web APIs, both calling them as well as generating them within your application. We think this is kind of a pretty big step forward for applications going forward. We think the support that we have that's new in MVC 4 will make it really easy to build them do some cool things with them. Before we get to the what, though, let's talk a little bit about why. Why should you actually care? Well, fundamentally, using web APIs and building web APIs of your own are going to enable you to build even richer apps and have even richer experiences for more clients. And by clients, I mean browsers, obviously. So all your web APIs you can call from jQuery, you can call from JavaScript or any Ajax framework. You can call them from Silverlight, you can call them from Flash, you can call them from a Win32 app or WPF app. You can also call them from other devices. So if you want to build a Metro app for Windows 8, you can do that. If you want to call it from Windows Phone, you can do it. If you want to call it from an Android or iOS device, you can do that as well. So they end up being a pretty clean way to expose functionality, expose data in a secure way, and basically build richer user experiences against them. Lots of people have built web APIs over the last couple of years. They're kind of multiplying like crazy. So if you've ever built a Facebook app, you're using their web API layer. If you've ever used a Twitter app on your phone, you're calling the Twitter web API. And you're going to see more and more APIs kind of get opened up over time. The interesting thing about most of these APIs recently is that they kind of fully embrace HTTP. They tend to use HTTP not as a transport protocol, which is what XML, RPC, or SOAP, or the WSTAR schemas typically used. They have their own kind of higher level explanations of things like errors and success and things like that. And then they just use HTTP effectively to tunnel it across the internet. Instead, typically with web APIs, you're actually embracing HTTP. You care about status codes, you care about headers, you care about URIs. And we want to make sure with the web API work that we're doing in MVC 4, we provide a really clean way in order to embrace all that and do all that. And with that, let's go ahead and write some code. So we're going to go back to our Redshirt 4 app and go ahead and expose some web APIs for the data we just created. And so to do that, I'm going to right-click and add a new folder. Now, you can add web APIs anywhere in your project. So I'm just going to put them in this APIs folder by default, mostly because I just want to group them in a logical place. But if you wanted to, you could absolutely put them in the controllers folder as well, that you put your typical controllers for serving out HTML or other content. But just to keep it simpler, I'm going to put it in the APIs folder, and I'm going to create a new item and add it in there. And I'm going to select a new template that's in the MVC 4 beta called the Web API Controller class. And I'm going to name this the Products Controller. And I'm just going to get rid of the default stuff so we can build it from scratch. This is what kind of that class is going to look like. And you can see here, there's not a lot there. There's not any conventions or any attributes you need to add by default. All we've done is built a class that derives from a new API controller base class that's built into MVC4. And what I can then do inside this class is expose action methods that I want to make use to implement web APIs. And so I'm going to say I want to have an API slash products URI on my website, which I want to use to retrieve all the products from our store. And to do that, I'm going to say return an iQueryable list, like so. And I'm just going to do that against our store DB context. So, and we'll just say return db.products, like so. So pretty simple, just returning a set there. Let's have one other API, and then we'll actually start calling these. And I'm just going to provide kind of a way to retrieve an individual record or product. And so I'm just going to say get ID. And in here, I'm going to return a product instead of a sequence of them. And I'm just going to say dbproducts.single e.id is equal to ID. So just like so, I'm basically exposing two actions. I'm using a RESTful-based standard here in order to do it. But I don't have to use REST, so if I want to use a different convention on the URI format, I can. We don't enforce REST, but we have a really nice way to do REST inside these APIs. And what I can do now is just run this app. And then we can start taking advantage of this. Now, we're not going to run it in the browser because these are APIs, since there's no HTML actually associated with them. Instead, what I'm going to do, just to kind of show off what's happening under the covers, is I'm going to use a tool you can download called Fiddler that makes it really easy to kind of simulate HTTP traffic to my machine and see the request response payloads and twiddle them so you can actually get a better sense of what's going on. We're going to have a built-in set of tools with the final release of MVC4 that allow you to, so you don't even have to use Fiddler. We'll actually have kind of a default client tool you can use in order to actually test out your web APIs. But for right now, I'm just going to use Fiddler. And so what I can do here is when Fiddler is, I can go to the Composer tab, and I can actually enter in a URI I want to hit. And so in this case here, I'm going to hit this slash API slash products that we created. And when I do that and hit execute, it's going to execute against the server. Fiddler shows its results here on the left-hand side, and when I double-click on it, what you can see here is that by default, we just return back all the products from our database, and they're encoded in a JSON format. And if I hit the raw button, which, ooh, there it is, you can see that's what the JSON format looks like. Fiddler has a nice JSON view that I can use, so I can actually see those results directly within the tool. And the beauty here is I just didn't have to do anything with JSON. I didn't have to encode it at all. I get that by default from the API controller. How many people here like JSON? How many people here like XML? How many people here like coffee? So let's say you wanted to see this in XML instead of JSON. Well, HTTP today provides a mechanism to express that. Does anyone know what it is? It's an HTTP header, and it's called, what is it called? It's called accept. It's 6 a.m. my time. That's why coffee is on my mind. But basically what you can do when you send a request to any web server is you can indicate what type of payload you want back or what type of payload you understand. By default, we'll send back JSON from web APIs. But if I want to, I could just say, hey, what I really want is XML. Hit execute. You'll notice there's a different icon here in Fiddler. And if I double-click on it, instead of JSON, what I'm getting sent back is an actual XML representation of my products instead. And the beauty here is I, as a developer, didn't have to actually do any code in order to support multiple formats. The web API has actually an extensibility API, so if you want to have your own custom vCard or whatever kind of format you want to represent your data, you can plug it in once at the application level, and then all your controllers can automatically support it. And we can basically serialize content in and out of the system however you want. We also, built into the web APIs, have other cool features. So anyone here using OData? How many people have heard of OData? Cool. How many people go, hey, I should use OData, but I've never had time to do it? Yeah, a few people. A few brave people. There's more of you out there, but you're cowards. So let's say we want to use OData here. Well, I could go ahead and just say top two, which is the way in OData you express, I want the top two results back, and I'm going to say skip two. So I want to skip into the sequence by two, and then I could say I want order by ID. If I go ahead and run that now and click on it, you can see we only return two results. There are two results into the sequence ordered by the ID. And I didn't have to do anything. Basically, as long as my web API supports iQueryable, we can actually do an efficient database query. So I'm not actually returning all the products to my web server. I'm only requesting the two products from the database that I need. And then the web API is automatically serializing it in JSON and sending it back. And if I want to, again, I could go back here and I could just change to accept application slash XML. And now here it is in OData form as XML. So really easy way. I can start to compose things in a really clean way, use any type of format, use OData, and get kind of a really nice clean programming model for doing that under the wire. And if I want to, I could then go ahead and say, let's actually return not the sequence, but let's return the specific second object, again in XML form. That's what it looks like. If I want to return it in JSON, I can either specify JSON or just because it's the default, hit that URI. And there it is in JSON. So really easy, clean way. I can expose any REST API. I can expose any data or any behavior I want. And I can use any format and integrate it within ASP.NET. Other things I could do. So we're retrieving data. Let's actually update data. So I'm going to use, again, you can use any format you want in order to express your API. I'm going to use REST. Typically with REST, you say I can post two API products to indicate I want to add a new product into that list. And then I'm going to return back the product that was created. And I'm going to say post. And I'll say product P, like so. And then I'm just going to say db.products.add p, db.save changes, and then return the product. So pretty simple little method here. One of the things you'll notice is I'm taking in a product object as an argument. You might ask, oh, how does that work? Well, let's take a look. So what I can do here is because I'm taking, expecting a product in, what I'm going to do is I'm going to post to this URL, the product's URL, and I'm going to include in the payload body some JSON. And so I'm going to say name is, what do you want to name the product? Rocks. Was it price or unit price? I forget. What did we name it? Was it price? So we have a price. Okay. And so we'll name this price. It's priceless, but for the purposes of this, we'll say it's $3.40. And so that's going to be a JSON payload. And just to indicate that we're sending JSON, I'm going to say content type, and we'll say application, oops, like so. Hit execute. And what you'll see here is we just posted this JSON format. ASP.NET MVC automatically pulled apart the format, created a product object, passed it into my API. We saved it in the database, returned it. And if I go now in the browser and hit products, I should have that added into my database. So you can see here, pretty easy way I was able to expose a REST API and call it. Now, if you're a web API guy or a REST guy, though, you'll say, well, let's look closely at what exactly did you do back and forth in terms of posting things. And if you look closely right now, we're not quite there yet in terms of what we want. Because if you actually look at the response that came back, we sent back the object that was created. And so we can see our new ID here. But if you look at, for example, the result HTTP status code that was sent back, we sent back a 200, which in HTTP worlds means success. But we really kind of want to be a little bit more specific in terms of the type of success. We succeeded, but we also created something. Ideally, I also would like to, in a REST world, let the user know what is the URI to the thing to retrieve data on the thing we just created. And often you use a location header in HTTP in order to express that. And so let's go back to our method here and make it a little bit more REST and Web API friendly and allow us to specify custom HTTP status code and custom HTTP header. The way we can do that is really easy. I can just say HTTP response message of type product. And this allows me to return not only a product that Web API will automatically serialize into the appropriate format, but it also then allows me to set some additional HTTP-specific knowledge around it that will be applied as well. And so then I can just say var result is equal to the new HTTP response message of type product of P. I can then say HTTP status code dot created to kind of indicate that I want to return back an HTTP 201 status code, which meant that I created something as part of this request. And I can say headers.location, I'm going to send back a pointer to the web API that will actually return back the information about the thing that was created. And so I'm going to say request URI, and then I'm just going to append onto it API/products. And then I'll just say, p.id.toString, like so. And then I can just return back the result. So basically, just modified that command a little bit. The API signature and calling it didn't change. But now, if we go back and say, compose another thing, and we'll say Netherlands rocks, and that's worth a lot more, and hit return, and then you'll see here, I now get a 201 back from the server. And if I actually look in my location header, I now have a URI that allows me to pull back the details about the object that was created. And in fact, if I go ahead and copy that and go and say product/6 and do a standard get here, like so. And do a request, you can see here, I just did follow that link, and I got back data about the individual record I just created. So anyways, the net take of it is, if you want to expose a web API, it's now really easy to do it. You can use any format, and you can fully embrace HTTP, and you can be kind of as down and dirty in the HTTP as you want. But at the same time, higher level things like formatting, security, and things like that are taken above. We will provide OAuth integration as part of this. So if you want to use OAuth tokens to secure things, you can. You can use the standard HTTP or ASP.NET things as well. So for example, if you want to authorize access, you can use the authorize attribute. So it's basically consistent with the rest of the ASP.NET MVC that you know. But it hopefully provides a base class that makes it really simple and really clean in order to actually publish and expose web APIs. So, you might say, but how many times does a random guy in a red shirt use Fiddler to hit my site? And is this really worth doing all this work with web APIs? Am I going to get the value from that one person? Well, the good news about web APIs, again, is anyone can call them. So you could build an iOS app, you could build an Android app, you could build a Metro app in Windows 8. They all have APIs for calling web APIs. And that way you can kind of build one kind of layer that exposes your data or some of your logic of your site. And then basically you could build a rich client experience across any type of devices calling it. You can also, importantly, call this from JavaScript. And this web API infrastructure provides a really clean way that you can integrate with things like jQuery, Knockout, Backplane, or any other Backbone, or any other framework you want, in order to build kind of a rich browser experience using HTML and AJAX. So let's take a look at some of that. So we're going to open another project, just in the interest of time. And so, and this project is in fact so simple, it doesn't even use any server-side code, it just actually has static HTML. And if I run this, it shows a few simple examples of how you can call things from JavaScript. And so I have a simple get that's going to return back a bunch of comments from people on the team. Basically, to call this from jQuery, you just do $.get, pass in a URL, and then just process it in your callback function. If you want to implement things like, things like CRUD operations, where I want to delete things or I want to post new things, again, it's very clean to do that. I could just do the $Ajax and use things like json.stringify and standard jQuery to retrieve variables from my HTML page. I can then just go ahead and post to a web API in web API using the standard jQuery mechanism to do it. And then I can just have return types based on the status code that comes back to determine what I should do responsively on the client, depending on whether things succeeded or failed or things like that. So really easy. Just use standard jQuery. It doesn't require a custom JavaScript library in order to use these web APIs. And we think we've been trying to make sure the defaults are really good so that if you want to build a rich client JavaScript experience inside the browser or you want to build an app with WPF, Silverlight, iOS, Android, Metro, whatever you want, provides a really clean way to do it. And the best thing is you can build that web API layer once and call it from any of those different types of experiences. Other things we've done as part of the web API is worked on cleaning up the testing story and making it really easy to unit test these types of things. How many people here do unit testing? How many people here hate writing custom fakes and mocks? Yeah, it kind of takes the fun out of testing. We try to make it really simple with web API so that you don't have to write fakes and mocks in order to actually test your APIs anymore. And so basically all your dependencies can now be supplied by simple constructor parameters, and you don't actually need to ever simulate a method call as on any of these objects. And at runtime, Web API integrates with a standard ASP.NET dependency resolver, so you can plug in whatever dependency injection framework or IOC container you want to use in order to resolve references at runtime. And so, for example, if you want to look at that. We can do so. So I have a simple controller here. I have two methods on it, a get and a post. The post and the get pretty much look just like what we did earlier. They're going against a repository. To test this, I can write some pretty simple unit tests. My test project, I basically just pass in a repository to my controller, and I can just call the method and then basically assert the result. And then if I want to verify that a 201 HTTP status code was returned, I can basically just create a product, post to it, and you can see here I can just assert that the status code that was returned was correct, and I can directly go ahead against the headers in order to assert the appropriate headers were returned as well. And then I can just say run the tests and make sure that the output is correct. And again, I don't have to fake or mock anything in order to do it. It all is just sort of works very cleanly. And again, I can go ahead then and have my repository passed in at runtime using whatever dependency injection framework I want. So testing is really easy as part of it. Other thing that we've done is we've heard from some people that say, hey, I love that you're integrating Web API inside ASP.NET, but what if I just want to have a command line console that exposes some functionality programmatically as well, and I don't want to run a web server, I just want to expose a few little things. So one of the things that's cool about this particular feature of ASP.NET is that you can host it not only within a full-blown ASP.NET app, but you can also host it within any other type of app as well. So you can, in fact, host this inside a WPF app if you wanted to, or inside a console app or a Windows service. It's the same programming model, but you even have more flexibility in terms of how you deploy it and how you run it. And for Azure, for example, you could run this inside a worker role. So let's see what an example of that looks like. I have a hello controller. It's super simple. Just returns a product or a set of products. So again, same programming model you saw earlier. In this case here, though, I'm running in a command line console project. And all this thing does is basically specify a base address I want to use. So I'm going to run it on port 8080. There's a little bit of logic there where I just map in the URI to indicate how I map my routes to my controllers, standard like ASP.NET, MVC today. And then I basically just say, hey, I'm going to run this and wait for requests. and then process them when they come in. That's all the code I need. I can hit run. It's now running on 8080. I can now say HTTP localhost 8080 slash API hello. And IE is going to helpfully run a security scan on my JSON because I'm trying to hit it directly. Oh, come on, it's not that much JSON. And hopefully in a second, it really is secure. Those red shirts aren't that special. Open. Or we can use Fiddler. Port 8080 slash API slash hello. And where I run this now, you can see that is both, that's being returned and from Fiddler, those two objects being served out of the command line console app. So really easy way to host your web APIs in any type of host. Tons of great integration inside ASP.NET MVC, so it's consistent across all types of MVC controllers. But at the same time, if you ever do want to host it inside a custom app or your own NT service, you can go ahead and do that as well. So lots of great things in web APIs. We're pretty excited about those. Mobile web. So the great thing about web APIs is you can expose functionality. You can call them from JavaScript. You can call them from native apps that run either in Windows 8 Metro, whether they're an iOS or whether they're Android or any other type of environment. We also think there's a lot of value in terms of if you don't want to create a custom native app for each platform, how do you go ahead and build a web app that can reach as many platforms as possible with a minimal amount of code? And one of the things we're trying to do with MVC4 is to have a great mobile web story so that you can do that. I showed that off a little bit in the keynote today. I'm going to go ahead and show a few additional things here as well. But at a high level, what we're trying to do with MVC4 is allow you as developers to basically build mobile-optimized experiences and allow you to start with as little experience or as little amount of work as necessary, all the way to building full-blown experiences that have rich interactivity. And you can basically choose along that spectrum how much time and how much effort you need to invest in order to enable each of those different stages of experience. How many people here build a site specifically for mobile devices today? Okay, a number of people do. Great. How many people would just like their site to work on mobile devices? Great. Hopefully we have an answer for both of you. So basically what you can do is by default, all of our project templates inside ASP.NET MVC 4 support something called adaptive rendering. And so basically that means we use CSS media queries, which kind of take advantage of the new CSS and HTML approaches, which allow you to actually have just one set of markup that at least adaptively redisplays based on your device capabilities. So what do I mean by that? Well, for example, I could, let's close Fiddler, I could go back to our Redshirt app here, run it. And one thing you'll notice is as I kind of resize the screen, notice how the HTML is adapting. So the logo's on the left by default. As I collapse it down and I get too small, it goes on the top. And basically the content's kind of automatically forming and wrapping appropriately. There's nothing really special in ASP.NET that's doing this. But it's basically our templates are by default now taking advantage of viewports and specifying viewports, as well as using CSS media selectors. And so the benefit here is, if I open this up, you can see the viewport, and if you go to our CSS files, we're using media selectors, and so by default, you get kind of a nice adaptive rendering appropriate to devices, and so if I hit this site with, say, a phone or a tablet, I could do so, and so this is what it would look like on, say, an iOS device. Again, it kind of adapts to fit to the appropriate UI and works and looks good. So that's kind of approach one that you can take as you're building your sites is just to kind of take advantage of our default project templates, use media selectors, and that way your site at least looks good on a device even if it's not mobile optimized. The next level investment that you can do is to take advantage of something we call display modes. And what display modes allow you to do is effectively override an individual view template, whether it's the layout template or an individual view or even a partial within your project. and have a mobile or device optimized rendering of that view in certain places. And you can do this in one place at just the layout, or you can even do it at every individual view template level. And that allows you to have one set of controllers, one set of URLs, but if where necessary, you can kind of optimize it for a smaller screen real estate and really kind of tighten it up far more than you can do with just media selectors. So as an example, let's go back to our Redshirt app. And right now, when I hit it with this with a mobile device, notice there's a lot of stuff at the top and there's a lot of kind of stuff there that I'm showing. And I might not want to actually show all of that on the page. I might want to just directly get to the content immediately. So what I can do is I can take advantage of this feature. Actually, I'm going to do two things. First, let me get rid of... do I want to get rid of that? Okay, yeah. Let me just refresh. Oops, no, sorry. I'm going to copy and paste this. And I'm just going to change my layout template. So instead of just having a layout template, I'm also going to have a layout.mobile template. And what I'm basically doing is, again, using kind of a convention over configuration approach within MVC to say, if a regular browser hits this site, render using the layout template. But if a mobile device hits it, I want you to use the mobile template instead. And what I can then do inside the mobile template is, if I open it up, I could replace all of this with mobile-specific code. And just so you don't have to watch me futz around doing that, I'm just going to paste some in. And what I've done here is basically move the navigation to the bottom of the list, the bottom of the page instead of the top of the page. Now, when I go ahead and refresh this, what you should see is, well, I actually got rid of the logo too, but you can basically see the content, and then at the very bottom, if I scroll down, oops, the emulator's not letting me scroll down, but you can sort of see at the bottom my about and my navigation links there as well. And so that's a simple example where my views didn't change, my controller didn't change, but simply by changing my layout page, I can now reduce cruft, I can focus on small devices, and I can customize it however I want. What's nice is you can not only just have a mobile view, you can even go to specifics where you have an iOS view or Win8 view, an Android view, or whatever type of definition you want. The actual prefixes we use here are custom, are customizable, so you can define any layers of extensibility you want, and you can have as custom an experience or not. And if I wanted to, for example, further customize the home view, I could just go in and say, oh, I'm going to have an index.mobile template as well, where I want to customize the content even further within it. And so you can choose at whatever granularity you want within your view templates that you want to override it, and you can have as custom an experience as you want, depending on different devices. And then if you want to go even further and have kind of a mobile optimized specific version of your site, we also have the ability. So if I wanted to create the, say, the Redshirt mobile version, I could select this mobile application project template, which is similar to what I did in the keynote this morning. This project template uses, among other things, jQuery mobile. And so it actually kind of fully embraces mobile and touch. And you'll see here it basically makes it really easy to have kind of a navigation experience on a mobile device. It has that mobile device. It also has animations built in, so you notice we slide back and forth. Ooh, very exciting. It also, jQuery Mobile has a nice mechanism where if you want to, you can easily change from predefined styles. So, for example, I can just say use theme C instead of theme B. And if I go ahead now and hit reload, it now has a slightly different style, so it has some built-in styles you can take advantage of, some built-in navigation patterns, and this allows you to run much more client-side logic on the client, and then I can go ahead and, if I want to, either do standard posts back to ASP.NET and render HTML. I could also start using that web API layer that we introduced in the previous section if I want to write more client-side JavaScript using jQuery Mobile to retrieve and post data and actually work at an API level against my site instead. So basically, you get a whole bunch of different options in terms of a spectrum that you can use with MVC4 for building mobile apps. It can start as simple as just use CSS media queries to adapt your HTML. You can use display modes to override view templates. You can build a fully immersive mobile experience. And if you want to, you could just say, hey, we're not going to have any UI. We're instead going to expose web APIs, and I'm going to build a native mobile experience that calls those APIs programmatically and have a completely integrated experience into whatever device you want. Moving along, real-time communication. How many people here are doing real-time communication within their web apps today? Yeah, no one. How many people here think that sounds cool, though? Yeah, it's cool. So, you know, a lot of times I get asked from people, like, hey, how do I push something from the server to the client so that the client gets an immediate update and they don't have to pull back and forth on the server? And usually that is a long discussion around that, why that's a bad idea and it's hard to do, and the people leave upset. And that's in the past. What we're trying to do in the future is make that actually achievable and relatively easy to do. There's one of the things that we're working on as a team is a project we call SignalR, which kind of provides a really nice programming model for doing it. It basically allows you to build multi-user real-time web apps. You can push notifications not only to a single user, but to multiple users. You can do server-to-client push as well as kind of RPC-style back and forth. And you can literally scale to thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of connections across a server farm. And one of the things we're actually doing also is even supporting the ability to integrate within Windows Azure and the Service Bus so that you could have any number of web servers talking to any number of clients. And so if you wanted to have like a million people all chatting in real time, which would be kind of chaos, but it would be kind of cool, it's a cool technical problem, you could actually do it. SignalR automatically negotiates the transport. So if it's a browser that supports WebSockets, which ASP.NET 4.5 does on Windows 8, will automatically use WebSockets. At the same time, it can fall back and use either server send events, forever frames, or AJAX long pollings. So even on IE7, this will actually work. It's open source, and you can download the source from GitHub. It's pretty cool. So let's actually walk through it here. Basically, the idea is you have a server and a client piece in order to enable it. On the server piece, you just create a class that derives from a hub. And within that class, and then you just name it whatever you want. Your JavaScript on the client, you import a SignalR library, and then basically you can set up what's called a hub on the client, which you can talk to this one on the server with. And so basically the code here just says connection.chat. What you can then do is from within any standard JavaScript on your client, so this is just standard jQuery, I can go ahead and send a message to the server. And I just expose whatever methods I want on the server, and I can marshal arguments back and forth between them. And then the cool part about SignalR is that on the server side, I can actually say clients dot, and I can actually call client-side JavaScript methods from the server. So this is using the new dynamic feature that we added in .NET 4 and with the languages there. And this is basically going to translate into a server push to the client to call any endpoint that I've defined in my JavaScript and pass in whatever argument I want. And it's kind of magic. But here's some cool stuff that what you can do. So it's pretty simple. In terms of concept, let's open up a simple project and kind of show what you can do with it. So we'll go here, there, 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 there. So what I have here is a class called MoveShape. It's on the server, and it's a hub class, and it has a single method called MoveShape. It takes an in and an X and Y, and it calls clients.shapeMoved and passes the value back. And so the idea is I can have any number of users connect to my hub, and when any of them sends a MoveShape command, it'll be rebroadcasted to everyone else that's listening. And this client's API is a dynamic object, so shapeMoved doesn't actually exist on the server. Instead, I'm indicating the client-side JavaScript function I want to call. Here's what the HTML looks like. So it's actually just an HTML page. It's not even an ASP.NET view, but obviously it could be. And I'm using jQuery, jQuery UI, and I'm using the SignalR library. And then here is all my client-side JavaScript. And so basically all I'm doing is I'm connecting to the hub on the server. I'm using jQuery to retrieve the shape object, which in this case here is just a div in my HTML, which is styled to be kind of a square. And then basically, every time someone drags and drops it in the page, so I'm using a jQuery UI function, I call the server method and pass in the X and Y. And then I basically just hook up a shapeMoved client method, which is what the server is going to call back on. And basically, as long as I'm not the guy who actually moved it, we'll update the HTML to be the position that the other person moved it as. So, simple, not much code. You're probably confused as to what it actually does, but let's run it and it'll become a little bit more clear. So, I got two browsers, one IE, one Chrome, both connected to this ASP.NET app using SignalR. And now, when one of them moves, the other one moves as well. And so you can see here, basically, I can keep them all in sync. And this is doing broadcasts, so if I actually had hundreds of thousands of machines connected, they could all be moving shapes. If you want sort of a better example of other things you can do here, there's a cool library or a cool website called Jabber. It's an interactive chat site, and so basically you can sign in. In the interest of time, I won't sign in, but basically you can again join chat rooms. You can broadcast across different people. If you want to do a stock in real time, you can use SignalR to push things in real time. Makes it really easy to use, again scales out to any number of servers. Last thing I'll mention, because my time is up, is asynchronous support. How many people here do async today in .NET? Okay, a few people do. The reason you might want to do it is it enables more efficient use of threads and server resources. Basically, the way it works is whenever you're going to call a long-range remote resource or a long-range operation, you can basically indicate, hey, ASP.NET, reuse this thread for another job, and then when my data comes back, reschedule me and let me complete. It's not exposed to the browser as a client, so you just still have standard URLs for your controllers or web forms. So the users don't know it's async. It's basically just internally implemented within your code. The benefit is it reduces the number of threads running, increases scalability and performance. Here's what you do today with MVC in order to enable it. We've supported it since ASP.NET MVC 2. It's a little bit messy code. You have to actually explicitly wire up callbacks. You have to kind of increment and decrement when you're actually doing operations. And you have to kind of manage the parameters that you pass. And you have a begin and an end method in order to do it. So this works today, lets you build really scalable solutions. But again, it's kind of a little bit messy. One of the things we're doing with the new languages that come as part of VS 11 release is allow you to instead take advantage of new async keywords that we're adding into C# and VB. And so now, anytime you're going to do a long-running operation, you can just mark a method as having async operations in it by just adding an async keyword in C#. And then anytime you're going to call an async method to, say, retrieve something across the internet, you just put this little await keyword in front of it. And what the compilers will then do is, when it actually goes to make this call, it actually will compile this method into multiple methods. And right after it calls this method, it'll return the thread back to ASP.NET. And then when the data actually arrives from Bing, it'll reschedule the thread and continue. From your program's perspective, it looks like it was a synchronous operation just like you might do today. But under the covers, it's actually now massively more scalable. The debugger still works, IntelliSense still works, makes it really easy and elegant to write super tight, efficient async code. And the great thing is it'll work across all parts of .NET. You can use this in WPF. You can use this in ASP.NET, MVC, and web forms. You can even use this inside command line console apps. And we think this is really going to let you take programming, specifically server programming, from a scalability perspective to the next level and get sort of tremendous scaling results with it. And you can use this with Web API. You can use this with SignalR. You can use this with standard controllers. So unfortunately, we're out of time, but hopefully you saw some things that you might want to play with. A lot more things and more features in this release, but these were just a couple of the highlights. Again, hopefully from a concept from a theme perspective, you saw some stuff like bundling, minification, database migrations, the Razor improvements that will just make your everyday lives easier as programmers, let you write less code and build apps faster. And I think with some of the things like mobile web, web APIs, rich real-time communication, and some of the async support, you're going to be able to build apps that scale better, reach more clients, and have a much richer user experience, and really change the game in terms of what you can do with them. Everything here works with VS 2010 and .NET 4, and it'll be built into VS 11. And so if you just get VS 11 installed and you find a new project, you'll find the MVC 4 project template there. And when the VS 11 beta comes out shortly, you'll be able to do that. And then also, as I mentioned earlier today, you can now download ASP.NET MVC 4 and run all the samples that I just showed here this afternoon on VS 10 and .NET 4. It's side by side with all the existing stuff, so it won't break anything. Here's the URL to download it. And if you go to the ASP.NET website, probably around 7 o'clock Netherlands time, you'll see it be updated, and there's a whole bunch of pages and a bunch of samples and tutorials that'll tell you more about how to use these features. So thanks a bunch, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the conference.